it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, the dire warnings of a former Secretary of State. Madeleine Albright says the seeds of fascism are growing in countries around the world, and we must pay attention before it's too late. So I asked her about the health of our own democracy under the current administration.
I believe in the resiliency of democracy, but I also am concerned about the fragility of democracy.
Then, aviator Charles Lindbergh was celebrated as an American hero in the 1920s. His name hit the headlines more recently when Donald Trump rolled out his version of America First, echoing words Lindbergh used to describe his own nationalist, even racist views. I spoke with Lindbergh's daughter about how she manages the legacy of her complicated family. Finally, I revisit my 1994 interview with Barbara Bush, who died earlier this week. But first, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright joins me to talk about her new book, Fascism, A Warning. Madam Secretary, how wonderful to see you again.
Great to be with you, Diane. Really pleasure.
I want to start with the U.S. airstrikes in Syria, along with France and the U.K. How much of a difference is this going to make, and was it the right move?
Well, I think that obviously what happened in Syria with a chemical attack and those horrendous pictures of children and terrible things. And so I'm glad that there was a response. But I don't think it'll make a difference because I can't see any strategy. The kind of one-off aspect of this, I think, is a problem. And we don't know what the strategy is because there has been such an inconsistent message from the White House of the president saying that he wants to take the troops out. Then, in fact, seeing this, because I think it did really move him from a humanitarian perspective of what he had seen, but there is no strategy, so that's what bothers me.
There had been talk of sanctions against Russia, and now President Trump is saying, not now. Why?
Well, I think that's a real question, because it makes so much sense. And let me just, there have been some sanctions. And President Trump, I think, did absolutely the right thing to respond to what the Russians had done in England by poisoning those people, and that Prime Minister May had wanted cooperation from the Allies. And the United States, in fact, expelled diplomats. And then the president agreed to a certain set of sanctions on the oligarchs that the Congress had wanted. So he's gone in that direction. The thing that made sense was some kind of mobilization of sanctions after what happened in Syria, because it is clear that the Russians had some role in that. And what I found interesting about the whole issue was, one, that the president didn't want the sanctions, but two, what it showed about the decision-making process. I know what it's like to be ambassador at the United Nations, and you are a cabinet member and a member of what's called the Principles Committee, which is the group that provides advice to the president on policy. When I was ambassador, we would check in to see what the timing was, what were the issues, how was it going to work. And I find surprising that Ambassador Haley either got ahead of the story or the story changed. And she had been, I think, a stalwart, in pushing back on the Russians in the Security Council. And so I think sanctions are most appropriate, but I find interesting, one, that the president changed his mind and went back again to no sanctions, and also what it showed about the decision-making process.
Madam Secretary, I want to turn now to your book, Fascism, A Warning. I'd like to have your definition of fascism.
Let me just say, fascism is not easy to define, but it has a number of characteristics. One is that it identifies with some nationalist group or some kind of a group of people that are very dissatisfied. And the leader, the fascist leader, identifies with that group. But fascism as a basis has this kind of ultra-nationalist identity issue. Then, as a result of that, it doesn't want anything to do with the other people. It kind of creates an us versus them and doesn't care at all about the individual liberties of that particular other group. It also has no use for any kind of democratic institutions. It thinks that either the press should be its handmaiden and do only the things that it wants, but definitely does not want a free press, does not want a judicial system that works at all, then, in fact, uses propaganda machines in order to get people motivated in huge rallies that may have uniforms and salutes and often some violence, and then doesn't want to have any discussion with people that they disagree with, and ultimately, and this is the ultimate thing, are willing to use any method to maintain power, a bully with an army.
What you have just said makes me think, even though you have already said publicly that you do not believe Donald Trump is a fascist, where does he fall short of being a fascist in your mind?
I think that he is undemocratic, that's for sure. And I have said that he's the most undemocratic American president of modern history. I think the various things that have not happened, thank goodness, is the whole idea of organized violence and of trying to control everybody about everything. And the truth is that if there were fascism or a fascist president at this time, I wouldn't be able to have this conversation with you. And so I don't think it's right to call him a fascist. I think that he has this sense of nationalism, there's no question. And the America First part, I think, makes me very nervous. I really am very disturbed at his approach to the press, and because we know that freedom of the press is the basic aspect of democracy. His lack of respect for democratic institutions is stunning to me. The judiciary, where he thinks he can order everything about. But I do think that there's that ultimate kind of, I'm going to have violence here, security, police, army, that only responds to the things that I want, which is what we saw and do see in some of the countries that are going in the direction of fascism.
So which leaders around the world do you see falling into that category?
Well, let me just say, some of the countries that I talk about, and I will, also have elements of fascism. I think, frankly, the only country I've just flat out said is fascist is North Korea, because there is complete control. There is fear that has been instilled. There is a family that controls everything, the Kim family. They also practice a way of treating their people where they have put them in labor camps, and this dedication to a leader that is almost, that they think they're godlike. So that is the only country that I just flat out say is fascist. The countries that I talk about that trouble me a great deal are what is going on in Hungary, and there was just an election there, a sham election, and then Poland, Turkey, and Venezuela are the countries that I spend, and then the Philippines. And those are countries where the leaders have, again, undermined any system of freedom and democracy and see themselves as the answer to everybody's problems. What I find really appalling, however, that those countries, all those people, actually got elected.
So why do you believe those countries and the people within them are so vulnerable to that kind of approach now?
Well, I do think, and it's a little bit different in each one of them, but I think that especially the countries in Poland and Hungary, in Central and Eastern Europe, there are historic aspects to this, and this is the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. And those countries, basically Poland had existed but had been partitioned many times. Hungary had been one of the leaders of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but all of a sudden they were independent. And they treasure their independence and their nationalism. What I think is interesting is because they feel that they hadn't been able to recover from all the aspects of communism, there are people in both those countries that feel that they haven't gotten enough of the economic pie, that they have not been really able to live a good so-called Western life. And they are looking for some easy answers. And in Hungary's case, what makes it even more complicated, this is very anti-immigrant. And so Viktor Orban has made very clear that all the problems that exist in Hungary have to do with migrants. And so there is this hyper-nationalism, that's one part of it, a sense that they have not been able to make the strides they wanted to in the post-communist world, and leaders who are willing and capable of mobilizing negative feelings on behalf of their own power structure and supporting their power.
Would you say that in this country there are elements of exactly those same characteristics going on?
Well, I do think that every country has divisions. There's no question. And the question is, how are they handled by the leaders? And so, you know, I'm an immigrant, a refugee. And when we came to the United States in 1948, 49, and we lived in Denver in the 50s, it was such a middle-class country to us and very different from some of the divisions that we had seen in Europe. And maybe there have always been divisions, but it was very clear recently that maybe as a result of new technology, people were losing their jobs. There also was something that I'd never seen before, the 1% that really had everything, and then everybody else. And so I do see the division. So then what happens is, I think, again, there are those who have wanted to exacerbate those divisions. And then also, I think there has been a sense, and President Trump has really encouraged this even more, is that we're being taken advantage of by the world. And so I am very proud American. Patriotism is one thing. Hyper-nationalism is dangerous. And that is what the America First part of things, the whole talking about that everybody, that we're a victim, which is ridiculous. This country is the most powerful country in the world. So I do think there are elements of that. And the part about fascism that I find so different than just authoritarian dictatorship is that there is this kind of rising from the bottom of people that are unhappy for one reason or another, and then a charlatan demagogic leader who then can take advantage of what's coming from the bottom and making it even worse and blaming somebody else. So there are elements of that in this country at the moment that does worry me, that we are, quote, victims, and then blaming immigrants, all of a sudden, all these people coming in that are either taking jobs or are terrorists or are raping people.
Do you believe that Donald Trump is a charlatan and demagogic leader?
I think he is a demagogic leader. And by the way, I actually think that he's brilliant at it. He knows exactly how to plug in terms of making people angry at somebody and finding people to blame for this. And then he also, while many of us don't like the fact that he has such a limited vocabulary, it is one that, in fact, gets people kind of thinking that he doesn't change his mind, that this is what he does, this is how he is, and that he does have a better idea for this country. And so I think that he is a demagogue.
What about those around him who say there are no facts, that what you read is fake news, that what you see is fake news, what you listen to is fake news?
Well, I think that he has clearly undermined what news is about. There's no question about that. And that whenever he doesn't like the facts, they are fake. But I do think that it is more and more complicated in our modern society to know what is information and what is coming to you from some echo chamber, and underlining various of those issues that I've mentioned in terms of exacerbating the divisions. And what it requires is for people to look at different sources of where they're getting their information, be able to compare sources, and not just listen to one thing, which, by the way, I try so hard not to do. I do drive around Washington, and I listen to right-wing radio, and I get fairly exercised. I will probably, you know, they probably wonder who the old lady is yelling in the car. But I do deliberately listen to things that I disagree with.
What about the role of Republicans and what they have or have not done to bolster Donald Trump?
I have to say, I so believe in bipartisanship, and I have spent a lot of time with some Republicans on the Hill because I've been so concerned about the State Department budget, and they have been very supportive of that. And so I think that's a very important part. I think, but I am surprised at their kind of willingness or submission to having their party hijacked, and that they have really not done very much. I think some of it has to do with concern during this election year that there will be some candidate who is much more further to the, it's very hard to put labels on anybody anymore, but basically much more in tune with what President Trump wants, and that they will be defeated. And so I think they are a little bit at a loss. They also think that often if they have some conversation with President Trump in the Oval, that he will actually do what he's saying, and then he changes his mind. So I think that it must be very hard for them trying to sort out where they are. And there are a lot of Republicans that I have known from various other administrations who are not for Trump, and they are trying to figure out how to mobilize, or maybe, and this is the part that makes me more nervous than anything, which is to normalize what's going on and say, well, this will go away. And the reason that I wrote the book is because I do want to put out that warning. You can't normalize what's going on now. You have to really go against it. And the thing I've been saying, Diane, is, you know, that saying, see something, say something. I've added to that, do something. So I think that Democrats and Republicans and independents have to do something about this.
Madeleine Albright is former Secretary of State, the first woman to ever hold that position. Talk about what you see happening there, the lack of filling positions, the lack of diplomacy going on, and the pushing out, if you will, of Secretary Tillerson.
Well, I think there are many aspects to this. One is that at a period during the transition, I was in some meeting with Democrats and Republicans, and the Republicans were basically distrustful of anybody that had worked in the previous administration, civil servants, and in the case of the State Department, the Foreign Service officers. I mean, I was kind of stunned that they thought these were people that were unpatriotic or didn't deserve to go on. So there was that kind of a sense in the first place. Then I think there has been a question about the budget itself. And when the so-called skinny budget came out, which came out of the Office of Management and Budget, Mr. Mulvaney, it was ridiculous as far as the State Department was concerned. There has always been a massive difference between the defense part of the budget and the foreign relations part of the budget. But this was really a blow of major proportions, and it went to the Hill. And that's when I actually met Republicans that I was able to persuade, or they were more than willing to give more money to the State Department. Then the part that surprised me was Rex Tillerson goes to the Hill, and one of the jobs of the Secretary of State is to defend your budget.
Of course.
And so what he did when those Republicans wanted to give him more money, he didn't want it, which really blew my mind.
Why do you think that was?
I have no idea. And I think that part of the issue was you know, he was not anybody that had ever been in government.
Right.
And I think I've only met him a couple of times before. I called to congratulate him when he was named, and he said he'd get back to me. He didn't. But I think that he wanted to reorganize the State Department without fully understanding what the State Department did. And so he kind of became a willing compatriot in the cutting out of the State Department. So that is, and just for numbers now, even on the budget that was just passed, these are in large numbers, but the Defense Department got over $700 billion, and the State Department somewhere around $39 billion, which is a stunning difference, and especially because you have to have programs in the State Department. You have to have diplomats. You have to have them housed somewhere. They have to be able to be the eyes and ears of the government abroad. They have to be protected. And then we have to pay our bills to the international organizations all out of that money. And it's ridiculous because in order to do diplomacy, you need diplomats. And then some of the reasons that the positions aren't being filled, from all I can tell, has to do with the fact that they are now wondering if the people agree with every policy. And a perfect example of this, Diane, was there was a man called Victor Cha who was named to be ambassador to South Korea. And his name had been submitted, and then he wrote an article in which he disagreed with some part of the Trump policy, and his name was pulled. So we don't have an ambassador in a country that is absolutely vital to us, given the fact that the North Korean issue is one of the most serious issues that we have.
What do you think the breaking point was between Secretary Tillerson and President Trump?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, I've read some of the kind of gossip about it, but I think it's basically that Secretary Tillerson at some point was reputed to have said that the president was a moron. And also, I think that he really did find that they couldn't agree on things. I think that Secretary Tillerson, even though he was not really the person that agitated for more money for the State Department, I think began to see the importance of diplomacy and that he was not able to carry on the diplomacy that he needed to carry on. But I think it was one of the more depressing aspects and just in every way demeaning for somebody to be fired. It's one thing. We often know that when people resign, they have been kind of pushed to resign. But to do the thing to him that the president did to Tillerson is just inhuman.
How do you see the relationship between the White House and the Department of Justice?
Well, I think what is interesting is that we do know that the Attorney General or other cabinet members is always to serve at the pleasure of the president. That is what it is. And as we just talked about Tillerson, when the pleasure is gone, you go. But I do think the part about our government is what all these departments do. And they are the structure of America, not necessarily in the power of the president in every single way. The State Department is the oldest department, by the way, Thomas Jefferson's. But the Department of Justice is for there to be a judicial system carried out in all honesty by people that have been there for some time, who understand what the law is, who are prepared to do their job as patriotic Americans. And actually, the strength of a democratic government is that the people who work for it are not afraid to give their views if they disagree with the president. So this whole issue as to whether people are loyal to a particular president, even when the president is doing something that is above the law, I think is one of the things that does frighten me about what is going on. And so I think that the president, frankly, because he's never had any government experience, this is not a company where you fire people that aren't performing the way you want. You know, we're not running hotels here. I mean, the bottom line is that there needs to be some recognition of the history of the departments that maybe the head of them do serve at the pleasure of the president, but these people and the Justice Department specifically, their responsibility is to make sure that the law is upheld.
In your busy travels for this book, I'm sure you have not yet had time to read James Comey's new book. I wonder, however, what you have reflected upon as you've heard him speak.
Well, I think that, he's telling his story. I think everybody has a right to do that. I think that he does raise this whole issue about loyalty. And I think the question is loyalty to whom? I think, as a public servant myself, you are loyal to the country and to the democratic system. And it's very good to work for a president that you agree with and that you admire. I had the honor to be able to do that. But I do think that one has to recognize that there is a sense about upholding something greater. And I haven't read his book, but I think that if he gets to the point really about the aspect of to whom are you loyal and what are your responsibilities when you are heading a part of the system like the FBI, you know, what do you do about it? What are your responsibilities?
And, of course, we await the results of the investigation by the special counsel Mueller. What do you expect?
Well, I do think that the special counsel has an inordinately important job always, but especially in this case. And from, again, what I have read, it sounds to me as though he's doing a very careful job and doing it in a quiet way, frankly. And trying to figure out how to get the people to talk to him. And I think he has a recognition of the fact that he is doing something that is basic to American democracy, of really trying to figure out if another country was undermining our democracy and whether there was any connection with President Trump. What the collusion word. But I think that his responsibility is to really protect our democracy. And I think that he is going to be valiant in the way that he continues doing his job. And I don't know what to expect, but my sense is that he is being very careful, systematic, has gotten a staff of people that are doing their work, and I think that some of the questions about whether he should be fired or not, or indications that he might be, to me would be a sign that those people that are saying that are afraid of what he's going to come up with, which to me, and I'm not a lawyer, would indicate that there is something to be afraid of for those that have, in fact, somehow been connected with what happened during this election.
Madeleine Albright, tell me what you think about John Bolton.
Well, first of all, I first met John Bolton when I was the nominee for the job at the United Nations. And he was the Assistant Secretary for International Organization. And the thing that happens in a normal transition process from one administration to another, the new people coming in get briefed by those people who are there. So I met John Bolton that way, and he was so negative about everything that the United Nations did, I thought to myself, why would I want this job? Very kind of doctrinaire about things. So, and then he was ambassador to the United Nations, where he was anything but a diplomat and made everybody's life miserable. And then he spent the intervening years really with some fairly outrageous views and totally disrespectful of people who disagreed with him. So the job of National Security Advisor is an absolutely key job in the decision-making process. And what you want is somebody who has, first of all, is an honest broker and wants to hear the views of others. I have been in the Situation Room with a number of different national security advisors, and those that are really good are ones that want to hear what the views are, and in fact encourage all of us to say what we think, not just stifle. Now, the power of the National Security Advisor is, in fact, to send a message to the president that would say, State Department thinks this, Defense Department thinks this, this is what I think. You get to put the paper on top. And that's fair. I think the president wants to hear. But you first have to evoke the other views. And then the part that is more complicated, the National Security Advisor is usually the last person to talk to the president before he makes a decision. And we now know about this president that he is very much influenced by the last person he has talked to.
More to come on that. I want to read you a paragraph from your book without identifying the person about whom you are speaking. You say, he fooled as many as he did because a lot of people shared his anxieties, like his vituperative style, and enjoyed watching the powerful squirm. Whether his allegations were greeted with resignation or indignation did not matter so much as the fact that they were reported on and repeated. The more inflammatory the charge, the more coverage it received. Even skeptics subscribed to the idea that though he might be exaggerating, there had to be some fire beneath the smoke he was spreading. This is the demagogue's trick, the fascist's ploy, exemplified most outrageously by the spurious and anti-Jewish protocols of the elders of Zion. Repeat a lie often enough, it begins to sound as if it must, or at least might, be so. Falsehood flies, observed Jonathan Swift, and the truth comes limping after it. You know that you wrote that about the late Senator Joseph McCarthy. How does that not apply to Donald Trump?
Well, I think in many ways it does. I'm not saying that Joseph McCarthy was a fascist, but what he did was take an element of something that people were afraid of, which was communism, and turned it into a tool to get rid of people that he didn't want working for the government. And it led to people departing or being pushed out of the State Department, creation of a blacklist in Hollywood, any number of different things. And it led to the following thing, which is something that I am deeply troubled by now, which is a suspicion of somebody else, that we don't want to listen to somebody that we disagree with at all. And in fact, I don't like the word tolerance because that's put up with, but we need to respect people that we disagree with, and we need to listen to them. And the kinds of things that McCarthy did disparage those that he disagreed with and also put their livelihood into danger by pointing them out. So I do think that there are elements of this. This is the chicken, the feathers being plucked. And the reason that you've got the book in front of you, and the important part, even though most of it is in red, the white part says a warning. And that's what this book is about. And trying to lay out what we've seen before as countries and people within countries move in this demagogic way, taking advantage. We were afraid of communism. There's no question about it. But to use it then as a tool to undermine the democratic system and get rid of people, and now what is going on in terms of undermining our institutions and not hiring people or letting people that are patriotic Americans work at the State Department, those are kind of elements of the same story.
So what should the role of people be? What can the people do? in this atmosphere?
Well, I think that there are things that have to be done, and they have to be active. First of all, we need to know what we believe in, which is the freedom of the press, the checks and balances in Congress, and the importance of people listening to others. But I think more people need to run for office, and not just at the federal level, but throughout the system, mayors, city councils, state legislatures. And those of us that are not running for office need to be supportive of those that are, and not just make it something about whoever, whatever person can provide the most money can in fact direct what happens. But there needs to be an activism and not a sense of just taking democracy for granted. And I know this is a paradox, and even as I wrote it, I knew it was. I believe in the resiliency of democracy, but I also am concerned about the fragility of democracy. And I spoke about coming to America initially in 48, 49. My father became a professor at the University of Denver. And he said there is nothing better than to be a professor in a free country. But he was concerned about the fact that Americans didn't fully understand how fragile democracy was, and that we Americans took it for granted. And we can't take it for granted. And so I'm calling for activism. And then I was so moved, as I know you were, by the children that were
marching.
And they wanted gun sanity so that they wouldn't have to wear flak jackets to school. And they got out there, and now they've organized town hall meetings. And I think it's remarkable. And we need to support them. And we generally need to support the younger generation.
Madeleine Albright, Madam Secretary, I cannot thank you enough for being here.
And thank you, because it's always good to have a good conversation with somebody who asks terrific questions and difficult ones. Thanks, Diane.
Now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's my conversation with Reeve Lindberg, daughter of Charles and Anne Morrow Lindberg. Her new book is titled Two Lives. Reeve Lindberg, how wonderful to have you with me.
Well, it's delightful for me, Diane. Thank you so much.
Reeve, your book is titled Two Lives. Tell me what that means.
I called this book Two Lives because it has seemed to me for many years that I live two lives. One of them is at my home in Vermont, which is an old farm. My husband and I live on a former dairy farm, and we've been here for many years, raised our kids, and the kids are grown and gone, and we have some sheep and some chickens, and we are much involved in the life of the town. But because I am the daughter of Charles A. and Anne Morrow Lindberg, I have another life, which involves travel and talking, sometimes about my own books. I write children's books for very young readers, but most often about my parents and their lives. And I have written a number of books, memoir, and a tiny bit of fiction that represents the life I knew as their child. So I find I come and I go between these two lives, and it's interesting.
For people of a certain age, such as myself, we know who Charles A. and Anne Morrow Lindberg were. Tell us, from your perspective, who they were and what they did.
My father, Charles Lindbergh, was the first pilot to fly nonstop solo in a little airplane called the Spirit of St. Louis from New York to Paris in 1927 when he was just 25 years old. He then became world famous for this feat, and he flew all over the world as a representative of early aviation because there wasn't much, hardly any, commercial aviation at all. And there was an effort to promote early aviation, to promote the aviation companies, the fledgling companies. He flew all over the world, first all over the United States, then down to Mexico, where he met the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Dwight Morrow, and Dwight Morrow's family, including a daughter, Ann Morrow, whom he later married. She was very shy and very much the diplomat's daughter, very well brought up, but still quite shy, and she would express herself, most of all, in writing. And then suddenly she became the wife of probably the most famous man in the world at that time.
He flew from New York to Paris, France.
That's correct.
Tell us what happened on that 33-and-a-half-hour flight.
Well, he flew from the Roosevelt Field on Long Island in New York to Le Bourget Field just outside of Paris. And there was a prize established for this flight, the first flight from New York to Paris, of I think it was maybe $25,000. Mm. And many, many people were vying to make this flight, including Admiral Byrd of the North Pole fame.
Of course.
And a couple of French flyers who were actually lost, flying the other way and died. There were many, many young pilots who lost their lives in the years of early aviation. So it was a flight fraught with danger. And my father's aircraft was quite humble, a wonderfully built plane that was made by the Ryan Aircraft Company out of San Diego. And the money to buy the plane was put up by several businessmen in St. Louis, whom my father persuaded to help him. He put $2,000 of his own, and the others put money in, and the whole cost of this aircraft was $10,580.
Wow. So when he landed in Paris, France, there were hundreds of people.
There were hundreds of people waiting for him when he landed, and he was completely surprised. He wanted a letter of introduction for when he got to Paris. He was afraid nobody would know who he was. He didn't know where he'd spend the night. Huh. And there were just crowds and crowds and crowds of people and lights everywhere. When he wrote about this flight, he said he didn't understand why the lights were there. And they were the lights of cars that had come to greet him. And they rushed him, basically. They rushed to him and wanted to get him up on their shoulders and carry him off. And it was quite the scene.
I should say, now let's talk about your lovely mother, Ann Morrow Lindbergh, whose book, Gift from the Sea, has been by my bedside for at least 20 years. How I love that book, and how you must have loved your mother.
Yes, I loved my mother very dearly. She was so brave and so quiet and so perceptive all her life. She flew with my father. They explored the first air routes over the North Pole to Asia. Off they went together in a different aircraft. And really charting air routes for the early aviation companies. But after her children began to come along, she pretty much stayed home with us. She did have help, but she had five children after the first child who died through the kidnapping that
yes.
was also very famous.
And indeed, they became even more famous after the kidnapping and murder of your oldest brother.
That's
it was
true.
A case called the crime of the century. What happened?
The story, as best we still know it, is that they lived then in Hopewell, New Jersey, and they had one little boy, Charles, who was very young. He was not yet 2 years old, I believe, and he was taken by means of a ladder that was put up against the window of his nursery. And for months, my parents did not know who had him or what had happened. There were ransom demands. There were negotiations even. Then his body was found in the woods near the home, and it became clear that he had died very quickly. Possibly the ladder broke. Possibly there may have been, he may have fallen as part of the frenzy of the original moments of the kidnapping, but he died. And my parents were involved with the trial and the, actually it was the execution of the man convicted of the kidnapping.
Richard Hauptmann.
And then they left the country with my two oldest brothers, John and Land, and lived overseas in England and in France for several years to avoid the frenzy that had developed around that event.
And, Reeve, you've said you were the youngest of the children. At what age did you begin to learn who your parents were and what had happened to that young baby?
I think that I learned that my parents were different and famous and something unlike the parents of my friends, probably sooner than I learned about the kidnapping of my oldest brother. But perhaps all of it kind of came together when I was 9 or 10, though I knew there was something different when I was even younger than that, because my parents were so careful about not letting others know who we were or having us not talk about private family things.
When you did get a little older and you did begin to understand who your parents were, how did you begin to reconcile the identities of your father? On one hand, the hero, and on the other hand, a man known for his nationalist and even racist ideas.
Well, you know, I didn't learn about the isolationist stance before World War II or the accusations of anti-Semitism or what I would clearly call racist in some of his remarks, again, all prior to World War II during the isolationist movement of which he was an important part. I didn't learn about that until I was much older. They didn't talk about those years, and nobody talked to me about that until I became, I think I was about a freshman in college, and my roommate, whom I liked very much, talked about my father's pre-war stance, and I was very, you know, kind of confused and bewildered. And she said, "Reeve, I think you should read his pre-war speeches." And I did. And I thought, well, of course people thought he was racist and anti-Semitic. But of course I didn't, because I had not heard this. He did. And he, of course, had claimed, he had felt that he was none of those things. He felt that he simply didn't believe we needed to go to war. I learned that my mother had asked him not to say certain things. And she said, "Everyone will call you anti-Semitic for the rest of your life." And he said, "But I'm not." And he clearly believed his views had to do with his patriotism and his wish not to, you know, not to have the country committed to another war.
I wonder,
it's complicated, I think.
Of course, very complicated. I wonder what your reaction was when Donald Trump adopted the same words that your father used, America first.
It made me shudder. I thought, oh no, not again. So, as I said, there was that movement that did not want the United States in the war, and there were indeed tinges of racism and anti-Semitism. We would like to believe that that's gone, but I don't feel so sure about it. I think it comes back, and I think we're seeing it come back at this moment.
Reeve, I want to ask you a difficult question.
That's fine.
And that is, How did you learn of the existence of your father's other families in Europe?
That was extraordinary. I learned about the existence of my father's other families in Europe through two of my half-siblings, one of them who was very eager to tell her story and was trying to reach us, but she could not reach. She found herself unable to reach our family, her half-siblings here in the States, and went to the newspapers or the radio or the media in Europe with her two brothers and gave her story. She had been asked by her mother not to say anything about our father during the mother's lifetime. Her mother died, actually the same year my mother died, and this young woman came forward. And at the same time, a half-brother from another family tried very hard to reach us because he did not approve. His mother was still living. He did not want this story to be public. And he tried to reach us, hoping that we could somehow stop the story from coming out. It was interesting. I did go to meet all of these half-siblings one summer just after the story came out. I took a train, several trains, and an airplane here and there all over Europe because I very much wanted to meet this family that I'd never known. And they were fascinating people, very intelligent, very interesting, in some cases eager to be out in public, in some cases absolutely not.
Do you think that your mother had any hint that this family existed?
To answer that question, I will have to quote a close friend of hers, and I asked her that question right away. I said, "Do you think my mother knew?" And my aunt thought about it and said she knew something, but she didn't know what she knew. And that makes sense, that my mother knew. He traveled a great deal. He was gone a good deal of the time, and then he would come back. And I think she had a feeling that there was a somebody. I don't think she realized there were more than one somebody, but I think she knew something was off.
So the question becomes, how does that knowledge that came to you late in life affect your thoughts, your feelings about your father looking back?
He was always a mystery to me. And I have to confess, I was furious for probably 6 weeks to 3 months, just furious with him.
And then, of course, he had died in 1974, for years and years.
And when I visited the family whose mother I met and whom I liked so much, her sons were also furious. One of them was also furious. And we walked back and forth in the rain. We walked in the rain and we both said how furious we were and how could he treat all these women this way. And we went on and on. And then it kind of went away after the fury. I had a sense of sorrow, of sadness on his behalf and on our behalf, but I wouldn't wish these people not to be alive, these half-siblings. I like them very much. And I don't think of these women as having really done anything terrible. I liked them. I think they were after the war. It was a terrible time for German women. And many of them, so many men were dead or jailed or who knows. And they had their children, and my father had helped with that. I don't know what I'd say to him if I saw him. I just was flabbergasted, I have to say. And I'm glad my mother wasn't alive when this all came out.
Indeed. Reeve, do you happen to have your book with you?
I do have it with me.
Well, there is a discovery that you made as you were going through your mother's papers. And it was on the back of a card. And what she did was to express what she wanted late in life. And as you perhaps know, I am very much involved with the medical aid in dying movement.
Yes.
And
yes.
I would be so interested to hear you read what she wrote, because it has such a straightforward statement of what I want for myself.
Oh, bless you, Diane. I would be very glad to read this. It was a card that was issued by the Euthanasia Education Council in New York, and she had it in her little purse, which I went through sometime after her death, and she wrote these words: "To my family, my physician, and any hospital, if there is no reasonable expectation of my recovery from mental or physical disability, I request that I be allowed to die and not be kept alive by artificial means and heroic measures. I ask that medication be mercifully administered to me for terminal suffering, even if it hastens the moment of my death. I hope that you who care for me will feel morally bound to act in accordance with this urgent request." And her signature at the bottom. I believe it might have been written and signed when she was in her late 70s.
That's what I believe.
She died at 94.
And she died in 2001.
She died in 2001, yes.
I am so admiring of her foresight and her strength, and I so appreciate your reading it for us. Reeve Lindberg, your book, Two Lives, is something that will remain next to your mother's book at my bedside. Thank you so much. For joining us.
Thank you, my pleasure.
And finally, former First Lady Barbara Bush died this week. I interviewed her back in 1994 for her memoir. Here's a short clip.
Let me ask you about the freedom to express your own opinions as First Lady and the extent to which I think we've all heard
I'm so sick of it, aren't you?
Sure, that you did disagree with your husband on the issue of pro-choice.
Well, first of all, you have every freedom in the world. It's whether you opt to do that or not. I had priorities in my life, and literacy was my priority. Abortion or anti-abortion is not my priority. But having said that, George Bush and I discussed that many years ago. He knew how I felt. I don't think the American public knows how I feel. I feel 99% with George on that. We both agree that adoption is a very good alternative. I mean, I'm the grandmother of the world's two most beautiful adopted children. We both agree that 1.6 million abortions a year is a disgrace. We both agree on parental consent. I feel that abortion after the first trimester is wrong. I mean, we have so many things we agree on. We both agree that abortion is all right in the case of rape, incest, and the life of the mother. The truth is, I agree with George. Really, 99% on
that.
What
about that 1%?
Well, I kept it to myself because I wasn't courageous enough to go into politics. If I'd been into politics, I would have spoken up. My husband ran. I didn't. And I had priorities. I didn't want to diffuse the literacy thrust I was making. And so I have no conflict in that at all.
You can hear that entire interview at dianereem.org. Go to the blog. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Danielle Brown and Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.